Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Keith Gave spent 6 years in the U.S. Army, where he worked as a Russian linguist for the National Security Agency. When he left the Army, Keith became a sports reporter covering hockey for the Detroit Free Press. He didn't know then how his Russian experience would play a role in his journalism career. Keith explains it all in his book, The Russian Five, a story of espionage, defection, bribery, and courage. This hour, Keith talks with fellow author, journalist, and hockey fan Tim Rapoli. Keith told Tim that he was working on a new project.
Mitch Albom, my buddy from the Free Press, called. And Mitch says, hey, Keith, would you like to collaborate on a project? You know, he's got my attention because Mitch doesn't collaborate with anybody. He gave me a nice blurb for the book, and I appreciated that. But he said, no, I got our next project, and I even got a name for it, you know, a book. I said, what's that? And he said, the next Russian you meet in heaven.
Perfect.
How's that sound?
Another winner. Now,
I'm kidding.
So, Keith, you know, this book starts and it hits you like a ton of bricks. You know, you're faced with a crisis of conscience, ethics.
Oh, you want to go there right away.
You're a good newspaper man. And there, you've got a devil in your ear offering you six figures to violate everything you've been taught.
Yeah, and stuff I didn't teach my kids in journalism school, I'll tell you that. You know, I spent 7-8 years in the newspaper business as a news reporter, spent my first year at the Free Press as a news reporter in the city desk. In the summer of 85, the sports editor offered me a job to cover the Detroit Red Wings for the Free Press, a major league beat and a major metropolitan newspaper in my hometown, essentially, of Detroit. I know how important sports is to that community, and you know, I took the job, and I covered a very, very bad hockey team, really bad. I covered kind of the last year of the Dead Wings in 1985-86. They played 80 games. They won 17. They lost 57, and they tied 6. 40 points, finished 21st in a 21-team league. So, you know, Jim Devolano, the general manager, is getting a little frustrated at the progress that the team is making. They need to build more of a foundation around Steve Yzerman to try and win a Stanley Cup for Mike and Marian Ilitch, because they're already getting a little impatient, especially 6 years later after they draft Steve Yzerman. 1989 comes along, and Devolano says, you know what, we're going to take a chance. I know where the good players, as he said just in the clip, I know where the good players are. They're behind the Iron Curtain. We're going to draft one or two of them and see if we can't get them out and play hockey for the Red Wings and maybe move this franchise along a little bit. And that's where I came into the story.
Well, also, you happen to be pretty close to being a fluid Russian speaker, and they just happen to need one of those to try and bridge the gap.
A great confluence of careers, for sure. I spent 6 years in the Army as a Russian linguist working for the NSA. I was in West Berlin for 3 years. After I went to Russian language school to stay out of Vietnam. I was drafted and had to go into service. So, yeah, I spoke the language pretty well. Spent 6 years in, got out, got in the newspaper business, started covering the Red Wings. You know, 4 years later, they're drafting Russians. And I got a call out of the blue from Jim Light. Called me in the middle of summer. He said, hey, Keith, Jim Light, would you like to go to lunch with me? I want to run something by you. And I'm a little skeptical because the only time I heard from Jim Leitz was when he was ticked off about something I'd written in the Free Press. So, you know, I said, sure, Jim. So we met at the Elwood Cafe right across the street from the Fox Theater at the time on Woodward Avenue. And he said, so, you know, we drafted these two Russian guys the last month at the draft in Montreal. And I said, yeah, I know. I wrote all about it for the Free Press. He says, yeah, we're trying to get them out. And he said, I want to run something by you, and if I cross any lines that make you uncomfortable in any way, let me know, and I'll just stop. Now my antenna is up. Now I'm thinking, what does this guy want to talk about? He said, well, you know, you speak Russian. You know our team. You know the league. You have media credentials, NHL media credentials. We learned that the Soviet national team is holding a kind of a training camp in Finland in a couple of weeks in August, and we were thinking that you might, because you speak Russian, you could write a couple of letters for us and pass along a message to these guys? Go over there and introduce yourself and try and do an interview. I use interview in air quotes. An interview with these guys, and while you're interviewing them, maybe you can slip them the message that we want to help them defect and come over to Detroit and help the Red Wings win a Stanley Cup.
Don't forget the money.
Well, first, as soon as he started, he gets talking about this, I'm going like this, time out, Jim, stop talking, because there's no way in heck I'm going to do this, not a chance. I like my job at the Free Press too much. This is a serious ethical breach. I can't do a favor for the team that I'm covering. And he said, okay, enough said. He said, did I mention we're willing to pay a lot of money? And I said, it really doesn't matter, but I was kind of half listening. All I remember about that part of the conversation was he mentioned the term six figures. And I know where that starts. And for a guy on a meager sports writer salary at the time, that's life-changing money. But I said, no, Jim, I can't do it. I'm sorry. I'd like to, but I can't. And he said, okay, we'll figure it another way. Well, I went home and, I couldn't let it go. Talked to my wife about it and just trying to figure out a way. And I'd read a lot of books, not a lot, several books, about newsmen who had been in Moscow working for a two or three year assignment at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Associated Press, and how they found themselves either wittingly or unwittingly in the middle of, passing messages back and forth to, operatives from the CIA, the KGB, and the usual suspects, right? And I'm thinking, maybe there's a way. So I called Lights back a couple days later, and I said, Jim, we might be able to do this. He said, how's that? And I said, I'm not going to take any money from you. I can't take a dime. I'll pay my own expenses to Helsinki and back on one condition. He said, what's that? And I said, I want to be your first phone call when these guys start coming over here. I want the news first for my readers of the Detroit Free Press. I want the first interview with these guys when they come over. I want first dibs on all things Russian for my readers of the Free Press. And he said, deal. And about 10 days later, I was on my way to Helsinki, Finland.
So you're on a red eye. You're on very little sleep. I'm sure you're guzzling coffee. And suddenly you've got to write two very important letters. How'd that go?
Yeah, it was rough because I hadn't been in Russian language school for about 17, 18 years. And I found myself digging into my Russian-English dictionary way more than I thought I would. But I got a couple of letters written, about two pages each. Basically outlining who I was, who the Detroit Red Wings were, a little bit about the team. I mentioned Steve Yzerman. I mentioned a Czech guy, Peter Klima, who had defected to Detroit a few years earlier. And I also mentioned, I had a couple of dollar signs in there. The Red Wings were willing to pay these two Russian guys, Sergei and Vladimir, the same kind of money that they were paying Steve Yzerman at the time, the highest paid player on the team. They're willing to pay these young Russians that much money. And they're willing to pay your families, for as long as you're a member of the Detroit Red Wings, we will pay your family $25,000 a year. In the Soviet Union at the time, they could live like royalty. So that was to entice them so I wrote those letters, and then it was a matter of trying to get those letters in their hands, and that was a challenge.
Okay, let's figure out what time and place we are right now. This is 1989. This is Glasnost. It's starting to be an open society in the Soviet Union. The wall has...
Berlin Wall came down in 89,
late
89.
Just coming down, yeah. But the Soviet Red Army and these hockey players, these hockey gods, essentially what they were, they play for the national team. They're the equivalent of national assets. And there's no way the Russian Red Army wants to let these guys go. They're the last vestiges of the Cold War, okay? So Keith is going over there, and it's borderline hostile circumstances.
It was more than borderline, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's impersonating a writer, which was not too tough, right?
That's what I've been doing my whole life, is impersonating a writer.
And he's in a covert operation, which he has been trained for, and again, you can't make this stuff up. If you had this as a script, you'd say, well, this writer really took a leap, saying, the hockey writer happened to be fluent or a Russian speaker. But it's all true. So set the scene. You're in a Helsinki hockey rink with your credentials.
Well,
and it's post-game.
Well, back it up a little bit. Sure. I arrived at the Helsinki airport at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I had to find a hockey game somewhere involving the Soviet national team. I had in this great big European capital, how the heck am I going to find a hockey game and then get in and find these players and slip them the message? And I just felt like I needed to hear the theme song from Mission Impossible, really. But I threw myself on the mercy of the lady behind the glass at the currency exchange. I said, where can I find a hockey game? It was about August 10th or 11th. She looked at me like I had three heads, right? And there was a man standing behind her, and his ears perked up at the mention of hockey. He said, are you looking for hockey? And I said, yes. He said, one of our Finnish club teams are playing the Soviets this evening. And he mentioned the arena. And I said, is there a hotel nearby? He said, there's a lovely hotel, the Radisson Blue, right across the park from the rink. And I grabbed my little bag. I wasn't staying long, my little carry-on bag. I got in a cab, went to the Radisson, and checked in, took a quick shower. It's now about 5 o'clock, a little after. I walked across the park and I got to the arena just as the Soviets were getting off the bus. And I see all these perfect specimens of athletes. I couldn't pick Sergei Fedorov out of a crowd because he looked like all the rest, kind of. The Soviets make good hockey players. So they get in the building, and now I use my media credential, my NHL media credential, to get in the building. Now I have to find a promoter sometime during the game to get me access to the players, the hard part. About the end of the second period, I found a promoter. He said, oh, yeah, you're from Detroit, NHL. I showed him again the credential. Yeah, I can get you down there. I said, I just want to meet these guys and kind of introduce myself and maybe ask them a few questions and do a little interview. I won't take up much time. He said, yeah, we can do that, no problem. And so the game ended, and we went down to the, he took me downstairs to the, I was in a hallway, my back is against the wall, the dressing room is across the hall. It's not like North America where the reporters just go into the locker room and start interviewing, hockey players as they're changing and showering. They brought Sergei and Vladdy out right out of the shower. They were dripping wet. They had white towels around their waist. They're looking at me like, who's this guy and what are we doing out here? They're cold. They got goosebumps all over their skin. There's a sheet of ice right behind us. And I'm introducing myself as a sports writer from Detroit, wanting to talk to them because they just got drafted by the Detroit Red Wings. They have no idea what I'm talking about. They learned that night, almost 2 months later, that they had been drafted by the Detroit Red Wings. That's the first they'd heard about it. So...
Well, let's talk some of the props here. You had a media guide, a little smaller than this, and then the letters that you had written are stuffed in there.
I had the letter. I'm trying to figure out a good time to slip them these things. And while I'm talking to these guys, I'm giving them little lapel pins, and so on. The Russians love little pins for their clothing and business cards. I showed each of them. I had the draft list of the all the players that the Wings had drafted. I said, there you are, Sergei, the fourth round, 74th overall, right there. Sergei showed no emotion at all. Just he would be a great card player, none at all. And I said, here you are, Vladimir, here you are, the 11th round, 221st overall. There's you. Vladdy bounced around, got excited like the kid who got the shiny blue bike for Christmas. It was really cool to see his reaction to this. Anyways, while all this is going on, I noticed about 8 or 10 feet down, his back against the wall, this guy's leaning forward, kind of watching everything, trying to eavesdrop on everything that we're saying and doing. I'm glad I saw him, because I knew who he was right away. You know who he was, right? He's the KGB guy. He was the guy to make sure that everybody who left Moscow for Finland went back to Moscow, that nobody was going to defect on his watch. It was like right out of Central Casting, this guy. It was easy to figure out. Sergei noticed them at the same time, thank goodness. I knew then when I noticed this guy, I said, it's time for me to get this job done and get the heck out of here. So that's when I got the little media guides out of my briefcase, and I said, I got these books for you guys. It's got all the information you could ever want about the Detroit Red Wings. There's one for you, Vladimir. There's one for you, Sergei. And then
at this point, the KGB guy raises his eyebrows and starts looking in their general direction, and that's the tease to this book.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Keith Gave talks about learning that Russian hockey players were defecting to play for the Red Wings.
We'll be right back.
listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Tim Rapley's conversation with Keith Gave, author of The Russian Five.
Months later, did you get that scoop?
The kicker to the story, the most important part, about 11 months later, after that first meeting that I had. No, I passed along these messages and I forgot. I was out of it. I accomplished my part of this little mission, and I went back to covering the Red Wings and just doing my job as a sports writer. About 11 months later, again, July 20th, somewhere right in there, I'm at my home in Dearborn at the time, eating dinner, and the telephone rang, and it's Jim Leitz again. Hey, Keith, this is Jim. I said, hi, Jim, how you doing? Trying to figure out why he might be calling me now. And he said, I just want to let you know I'm on Mr. Ilitch's airplane flying back from Seattle, Portland. Guess who's sitting next? They were at the Goodwill Games. I said, guess who's sitting next to me? I said, who's that? And he said, Sergei Fedorov. I pushed my plate away. I got my notebook out. I started, I'm looking at my watch, wondering if I could get this story in the first edition of the newspaper. Talked to him for about 10 minutes or so, got everything I could get in a very short time. Then I called my desk at the Free Press. I said, what's going on page one tomorrow? And they said, why do you care? I said, because whatever you got, I'm going to blow it out of the water. I'm just giving you a heads up. And they said, what's that? I said, well, I just got a call from the Wings. There's a Soviet defector on his way to Detroit to play hockey for the Red Wings. Pause. You got 35 minutes. So I fired up the laptop and I started typing fast and furiously. 35 minutes later, I hit the button, sent it off. The next morning, about 6:15, I wake up and I look on my doorstep, and there's the Detroit Free Press there. Remember those days when it was delivered to your doorstep 7 days a week? Those wonderful days. There was my newspaper. I took it out of the plastic sheath. I opened it up, and there it was, page one, above the fold, Soviet defector on his way to Detroit to play hockey for the Red Wings.
Terrific
and,
stuff.
And that's how the Russian Five got started. But the bottom line for me as a newsman was, I was back to this ethical breach for a second.
Exactly.
I was a newsman making a deal with a source. It happens every day in the news business. Every day, reporters are making deals with political sources or environmental sources, whatever. I'll print this if you give me that. You know, you're constantly making deals for information. I won't print this if you give me that more often. Bottom line is, I got the story first for the readers of the Detroit Free Press, and that's all that mattered to me. 2 days later, I had Sergei Fedorov across the table, and I was interviewing him, and that was on page one of the newspaper a few days later. Following year, Vladimir Konstantinov come. We just beat the hell out of the Detroit News for on all things Russian, just like Jim Leitz promised. I had it all, and that's what mattered to me, and that's why I made that deal.
Terrific stuff, yeah. Now, I'm going to take kind of the big macro view of this, and I'm reading this book, and I'm saying, this is Keith Gave, hard-boiled journalist. You know, I was working in sports entertainment, essentially. I saw Keith at four straight Stanley Cup finals, and, the production people would always pick up his newspaper, whether it was the Dallas Morning News or the Detroit Free Press, to make sure we were following all the storylines. And he's like the quintessential, hard-boiled journalist. And now I'm reading his book, and he's inserting himself into the story, and I'm thinking, Is this guy comfortable doing that? Because that goes against everything I had understood.
We write the news. We are not the news. And that was hard part for me. But I had to tell the story properly. And there's a fair amount of navel gazing, self-reflection. I try and tell the story that I just told here, not that I did it. I confess that I did it, and I explain why I did it as I just did, and it worked out. And the really important thing to me. Nobody knew any of this stuff until this book was published last year. Nobody knew anything. Nobody. I did not talk to my editors about this because I knew what they'd say. So I didn't confide in my editors, and that pains me to this day because trust is so important in our business. But it worked out. And years later now, after the book was published, my former editors at the Free Press, people I respected immensely, who gave me all these great chances to, you know, do what I did for the Free Press. When the Red Wings won the Stanley Cup, I went to Moscow for 10 days when the Russians took it back and partied around Red Square with those guys, partied a little bit. I was there while they partied. But it was a glorious time, and I felt like I was really worried about how they would react when they saw my confession in this book. And you know what? All I heard was, great job. This is a great story. Well done. I love the story. Nobody even brought it up. And the Detroit Free Press, my alma mater, ran 5 weeks of excerpts on Sunday leading up to the world premiere of the production, the Russian Five movie. So I felt like if there was anything to forgive, all was forgiven. That was really, really important to me. I've taught journalism for 15, 16 years. I would never tell my students to do what I did. I'm like a parent. Do what I say, not what I do, right? Yeah.
So you've got this fantastic story of going over to Finland, the neighbor of Russia, talking to these guys, and you know, basically on a covert operation. How long did you sit on this story?
How long?
Like 13 years. Wasn't
well, I sat on the story for, you know, until I told it in the book, really.
Several decades.
Man, yeah. I knew I needed to get out of the newspaper business before I told it, for one thing. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. And it was really funny. On June 7th, 1997, when the Red Wings won the Stanley Cup the first time, I'm working my way around a very, very crowded Detroit dressing room. Talked to Jeff Daniels a little bit, you know, shaking hands with all the players. It was impossible to take notes because champagne was spilling all over the place. I couldn't read my notes anyways. But I got over to Sergei's corner of the dressing room, and believe it or not, Sergei was surrounded by some beautiful women. Anna Kournikova, for one. Anyways, I congratulated Sergei. I said, Sergei, molodets, good boy, way to go. Congratulations. I knew how important the winning of the Stanley Cup was to him. And, you know, he said, thanks very much. And he said, then he leaned forward. He said, hey, Keith. And I said, yes. He said, you remember that night long time ago in Helsinki? I said, yes, Sergei, I remember that night. He said, I never tell anybody. I said, good, don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody.
That's terrific stuff. Now, I'm also reading shortly thereafter, you're up in the owner's box. And, you know, there's champagne up there, they're embracing you, and I'm saying, how is this hardcore journalist, you know, dealing with this, that you're now on the inside to talk about that scene up in the player's box? This is with Illich,
and he's
treating you like an insider, and that's what I was telling Ann Stanton, to call this thing the insider.
Yeah. That was kind of my story the next day, where about Mike and Marian Illich, who put their heart and soul and a lot of money in building this this hockey franchise and bringing us a winner. The one thing I'm real sad about, that Mike Illich never got the World Series championship that he spent so much money to try and bring to Detroit. But that night, they were spraying around champagne, vintage 1982 Moet. Is it Moet? Is that right? Moet? Moet? Champagne. 1982 is when he bought the franchise. 1997, 15 years later, they're spraying around all that probably pretty good champagne now. I don't know. Booze
sure
much,
is,
but,
yeah.
But anyways, so they ran a good time in the owner's suite there. And Mike, you know, saw me. His daughter Denise brought him over to see me. And I reached my hand out to shake hands and congratulate him on breaking a 42-year drought of the Stanley Cup. And he looked at me and said, I'm not shaking your hand. Get over here. And he put me in a great big bear hug. Just probably had a few drinks, you know, good for him. But he gives me a big hug, and he said, you're the guy who brought me them Russians. He said, without those guys, we don't win this thing. He said, you did it. You're a big part of this. He's going on and on. I said, Mike, relax. I'm trying to distance myself, right? But he's giving me a little credit, and which I didn't even want to talk about.
Did that make you feel uncomfortable?
It did. It did a little bit. It did. It was because it was his moment. It was all his. It was all theirs. I had nothing to do with it. I downplayed whatever role I had. I tried not to think about it. This was their moment. That's all I'll say. But, you know, the kicker to that story is a year or so later, I was down in Dallas working at the Dallas Morning News.
Let's segue to the transition to writing a book from being a deadline reporter, which is a whole style unto itself. And we spoke at length yesterday with Ann's National Writers students about, you know, what that newspaper style is and getting that lead out, and you're building it like a pyramid, and you're writing under deadline, you have a certain amount of time, and now you're taking on a 300-page book project. Yeah. Tell me about the learning curve and if you hit any bumps.
Yeah, it was different. I mean, the one thing, honestly, you said it best when I was impersonating a writer all those years, because that's how I felt, really. I never fashioned myself as much of a writer. I was a good reporter. I could get news, I could package it, and I could write it really fast. And when you cover a professional sports beat who play most of their games at night, and you're working for a morning newspaper, writing on deadline is paramount. It's hard to do. If you can do it well, and I could do it pretty well, I could make a pretty decent living. After I finally retired, after 15 years of teaching, a few years ago, I decided to enroll in an MFA program. And trying to get some help finishing this book because I got
Masters
started.
Of Fine Arts.
Masters of Fine Arts, right? And I'm in this MFA program. First day, cohort groups around. We're all introducing ourselves, right? It came to me and I said, my name's Keith Gave. I'm from Detroit. I've spent 40 years or so in the news business stringing words together. And I'm here to learn everything I've been doing wrong all these years. And I laughed. And it turns out the joke was on me. This MFA program and the mentoring I got was paramount, really, in helping me write a better book. I got a lot of good advice. Working with other writers, learning about their process, learning how to massage sentences and paragraphs and so on. I learned a ton kind of too late. I wish I'd done this when I was 25 years old instead of 40 years later. But you know what really got me thinking about writing more than reporting were those having a beer and a pizza with Mitch Albom after a hockey game in Edmonton, just going out afterwards. We didn't talk about sports. What Mitch wanted to talk about was writing. And I was getting my first mentoring, you know, about writing. And Mitch is talking about cadence and rhythm and lyricism, you know, short sentences, long sentences, you know, repeating phrases and so on. I just sat back and listened to Mitch. I admired his writing, and now I'm listening to how he did it. And I started thinking, maybe I could try actually writing, too, along with the reporting. That's how it kind of got in the back of my mind. That's why I started kicking around this idea of an MFA program. I'm glad I did.
And not only were you writing a book, but you were also an associate producer and a writer on this Smoking documentary. And you're doing them, they're dovetailing together. Can you talk about that process and how one might have helped the other?
Well, it was, what do you call it, symbiotic, is that a word? I don't know. I got a call from a young director in, would have been about 2013, I think. He had spoken to Jim Leitz about his interest in doing a documentary about the Russian Five. And Leitz said, well, before you do anything, you got to talk to Keith. Keith Gave. He knows everything. He was there from the beginning. You got to talk to him. Start with him. And if he buys in, he has the credibility with the Russian players, with the Detroit Red Wings, their management, and everybody else. So Joshua Reel is the director's name. Joshua called me, said, would you be interested? And I said, yeah, because I know it's a good story, and I'd love to tell it. I said, I'm in the middle of writing a book as well, and I could see how my involvement in this project can help me get material to kind of flesh out chapters I needed for the book. And so we started to work on it, and you know, over the course of about 3 years or so, interviewing everybody we needed, almost everybody we needed, we went to Russia, where we interviewed Sergei Fedorov, who, when he was there and still is, the general manager of the Central Red Army Club that he defected from. We interviewed Slava Fetisov in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. And if you've been following the news about our president, there's a story about him in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. That hotel, and Slava Fetisov, by the way, is this close with Vladimir Putin. Slava is a senator in the Russian parliament right now, very powerful politician. And we interviewed Slava Kozlov, the quietest of the five, the one we tend to forget and we shouldn't. But Slava is returned to Russia, and he is now coach of his hometown club in the Continental Hockey League in Voskresensk. He promised his father, who was a famous hockey coach in Russia, that when he was done playing in the NHL, he would try coaching. And he did. He was an assistant coach for club teams there for a while. Now he has his own team. I'm really, really proud of Slava Kozlov because he's going to be a great coach like he was a great hockey player.
Yeah. So, you know, when we talk about this book, you know, there's plenty of triumph and tragedy. I think everyone knows about the terrible limousine accident that nearly took the life of two of the members and yeah. and the beloved trainer.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, there's a historical significance, stuff that I'm interested in the evolution of hockey. And what the Russians introduced, starting with the Red Wings and then to the rest of the National Hockey League, they introduced a sport that was actually different than Canadian hockey. We all think Canada invented hockey, but that's not really the case. They played a sport. Do you know the name of that sport that the Russians played?
You know, I learned about it when I was interviewing Igor Larionov. It was in 95. They were a real, real good team, and they were favored to win a Stanley Cup that year. They got swept by New Jersey in the finals. But I did this long, one of the longest stories I ever wrote for the Free Press about Russian hockey. Now we got these Russian five together. It might have been 96. That doesn't matter. But I'm sitting in a Santa Monica low Santa Monica hotel with Igor, the yep. professor, with his little wire rim glasses, asking him for background on hockey. And he said, "You know the sport bandy?" And I said, "No, I don't." He said, "It's played with 11 men on ice with six and a ball. And we move the ball down the field, and we try and score into the goal."
It's essentially a soccer field, right?
Yes.
It's three times as long as a hockey rink.
And I'm intrigued. And he said, "This is the history of our sport." And I said, "So you're telling me that Russian hockey doesn't come from Canada? Russian hockey comes from Russia." He said, "Yes, very strongly, very adamantly. We didn't steal their game. We had our game, and we play this game of ice hockey better than those guys do." And you know what? They did, didn't they? They did. Igor Larionov was the fifth of these guys. The Wings drafted three guys. Slava Kozlov was the third guy they drafted. And then they traded for Slava Vatisov, the old defenseman. And then they traded a 50-goal scorer in Ray Shepard for Igor Larionov. For an old center iceman who wasn't scoring a lot of goals. And Jimmy D was not real happy about that. The general manager, "Scotty, what are you doing? Those 40, 50 goal scorers, they don't grow on trees. You're going to train them for a 35-year-old center scores, what, 10, 13 goals, something like that?" Yeah. That's what I want to do, Jimmy. That's what we're going to do. And Jim Devolano and Ken Holland, they kind of put their foot down a little bit, and there's a little bit of a debate going on between these two guys. Scotty finally says, "Look, you brought me here to win, right? You want to win? Then we're going to do it my way. If you don't want to, let me know and I'll just leave." So, I mean, Scotty put his foot down. They traded a 50-goal scorer for Igor Larionov. Now they got five.
That's a magic number now in Russian hockey.
Russian hockey is played in five-man units, as opposed to North American game where you throw three forwards out there. They play a little bit, and you switch defensemen, the two defensemen back and forth. They're changing all the time. Five guys rarely play together for very long on the ice. These guys, he threw them over the boards for the first time on October 27th, 1995, and it was magical. Magical. It was in Calgary, in a very good Calgary team there that then. The Wings won the game 3-0. Russians scored two of the three goals. The first goal, if you go on YouTube and look up the first goal that the Russian Five scored that night, Slava Kozlov scored it on an assist from Sergei Fedorov, on an assist from Vladimir Konstantinov. It was a thing of beauty. The Wings outshot Calgary that night 25-8. Calgary had eight shots on goal the entire game. The Russians had 15 of Detroit's 25 shots. The Russians played a puck possession game. They had the puck all night long. It's hard to score when you're the other team when you can't get a hold of the puck. And that transformed the National Hockey League. It got contagious among the Detroit Red Wings, all the rest of the players. The North American players saw how they were playing. "Boy, that looks like fun. Why don't we try that? Let's play keep away. Don't let them have the puck." That was Detroit style. And you've been watching copycat hockey since 1995. Every team in the league, the best teams in the league, still play puck possession hockey. They changed the game. They changed the sport.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Keith Gave reads from his book, The Russian Five.
Thank you.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Tim Rapoli's conversation with Keith Gave.
Now, I'd like to talk about the Russians. You have five such special characters. Now, I want to go back to the sense of Cold War assets and when Russia was trying to establish its place in the world, obviously Olympic results were really important, but like in Moscow itself, their big cultural center, the Bolshoi Ballet, you know, those people were in, you know, Baryshnikov, so yeah. Important, right? The cosmonauts, the guys in the space race who are going into outer space, they were the proudest people that the Russians. So the Russian national team, this Central Red Army team, were of that exact caliber, were that important to them. And so this really affected the negotiations because the hardliners who are still at the Central Red Army in the late 80s and early 90s, they don't want to give up those assets. And they say, well, there's a transfer fee. There's an established rate of $250,000. Why can't we just make a deal? And,
right.
And why didn't that work?
They were some of the most precious resources, the elite athletes, the hockey players especially. They like winning gold in the World Championships and the Olympic. They didn't want these guys to go. The Wings tried to go in the front door with Sergei Fedorov. They approached the Russians. Valery Gushin was the general manager of the Red
Minister
Army Club at the time.
Of sport or something.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Yep.
But they said, what's it going to take to get Sergei Fedorov, to Detroit, North America? And they said, $300,000. And Jim Leitz didn't blink. He said, okay, I'll write the check right now. Oh, but you can't have him until he's 28 years old. That's how they were. You know, there was a transfer fee, but they still weren't letting their younger players go. Again, they wanted to keep them. The country is starting to open up for a lot of people. Citizens are starting to be able to travel a little bit. They're getting their passports. They're able to travel freely. A lot of people are able to do this in the former Soviet Union when it becomes the Russian Federation, except for the athletes. These guys are sequestered in a barracks. They live there 11 months a year. If they're lucky after a game, they can spend an hour or so with their wives and family, and then it's back to the barracks. 11 months a year they did this, practiced 3 or 4 times a day, and they felt like they were slaves, and they were. They got 1 month off the entire year to kind of take a vacation, do what they needed to do, and so on. But otherwise, they were sequestered. Their lives were not their own, period. And they wanted freedom. And they knew they were being drafted now by the NHL, and they wanted to get out. But the only way they could do it, even 89, 90, countries opening up, you still got to sneak out of the country, defect. And that's how the first two guys did it. And the most fascinating story of all is Vladimir Konstantinov. He was a captain. He held the rank of captain in the Red Army Club. And he was after Fetisov came to America to play for New Jersey, Konstantinov was the new captain of the Red Army Club and the Soviet national team. The captain. He held the rank of captain in the army. He had a 25-year commitment. Sergei's already defected, come over here. Vladdy's next. But they don't know how to get him out. He's got this commitment. You go AWOL and defect and come to North America to play hockey, you're not going to get a work permit, a visa to work in this country because he's considered a criminal back there. First, he's got to get out of the army to even think about defecting to come over here.
They're wary. The Russians want no part of this. They've already lost one guy. And on the other side of it, okay, you've got Ilitch sending his special contacts, his envoys, no longer Keith, but a guy who was a former doctor.
The same guy who helped Sergei come out, his name was Valery Matveyev, and it happened to be a sports writer, too, for Pravda. At the time, and he was helping. He helped Sergei get out. Once Sergei got out, Jim Leitz had a meeting with him and said, okay, now how are we going to get Vladimir out? You know, Konstantinov, we need this defenseman. How can we get him? He said, I don't know. I'll be back with you. I'll try and think of something. A couple of months later, Valery shows up. He said, I think I got an idea. I'm going to need some money. And Leitz says, how much do you need? He said, about $30,000. Leitz didn't blink. He got $30,000 of Mike Ilitch's cash. The guy went back, and the one thing that Valery did say, because Jim Leitz did say, what are you going to use it for? And Valery said, well, I need to bribe some doctors. They bribed some doctors, got doctors to diagnose that Vladimir Konstantinov had an inoperable sarcoma, cancer that they couldn't cure, so you might as well let him out of the army.
And maybe he'll get cured.
And maybe he'll get
Mayo
cured.
Clinic.
Yeah, if he goes somewhere else, you know. But the problem with that is
that the Gushin, the general manager of the club, didn't believe it, didn't believe the doctors, wanted a second opinion, sent him to a Red Army hospital, military hospital, lots of high-ranking doctors and officials, people walking around with machine guns and so on, to get that second opinion. Valery Matveyev comes back to lights and said, I'm going to need a little bit more money. How much you need? I need another $30,000. He said, okay, you got it. He said, I need something else too. And Light says, what's that? He said, one of the doctors wants a car. He wants the biggest American car they make. And so Light went out and bought a big old Chevrolet Caprice, big boat of a car. Bought the car, shipped it over, never saw or heard from it again. Valery goes over there, starts bribing those doctors in the military hospital. They come up with the same diagnosis that the other doctors, it's amazingly, right? And Vladdy is now out of the army and able to defect. And that's only half of a great story.
It's duffel bags full of Little Caesar's money, cash going in as they're tearing apart the final assets of the former empire.
Yeah.
You know, so it's it's West meets East. Some amazing characters, like all five are worthy of their own biography. This Slava Fetisov, who you've spoken about, who's a fascinating story, you know, he's now the subject of three films,
yes.
Right? There was Red Army by Gabe Polsky. There mm-hmm. was a great ESPN documentary.
Yes.
Fetisov was at Cannes Film Festival a couple years ago. I mean, he's become this megastar. His face looks like a Picasso painting. You know, he's got eyes over here and lips over there and a nose twisted. And he's got this heart as big as gold. He's a great politician. And he had one of the saddest pathos of any moment I've ever read about in sports that you found out while doing the documentary by going to one of your sources who was a flight attendant on the private plane. Can you try and describe that scene in 1995?
Yeah, Denise, the flight attendant talks about, you know, the Red Wings traded for Slava Fetisov in early 1995. He wasn't playing much in New Jersey. New Jersey had a pretty good hockey team, as the Wings were about to find out. Wasn't playing much. I had come back. I was over there in November of 94. The league was on a lock. Their first work stoppage, they locked up the players, and the Russians took a bunch of young players over there. NHL stars, former NHL stars, went back to Russia, barnstormed while the lockout was taking place. And I saw several of those games. I wrote about it for the Free Press, and that's where I met Valery Matveyev, who told me all these other stories. But I watched Fetisov play. I came back to Detroit, and I saw Scotty, and I said, Scotty, I know you're always looking for defensemen, defensive help. And I said, Fetisov's hardly playing in New Jersey, but I saw him play over there, and he looks pretty good. But don't take my word for it. Talk to Sergei. It looks like he can still play, and you probably get him cheap from New Jersey. And
again, you're playing the role of insider.
I kind of did then. I felt like I was a scout. You know, but I knew Scotty wouldn't really take my word for it, of course. He talked to Sergei. Sergei says, heck yeah, try it for this guy if you can. And, you know, a few weeks later, he brought Slava Fetisov to Detroit. Slava is the players were skeptical. Steve Eisner remembers being very skeptical. This old Russian here, what's he got? He's not even playing in New Jersey. How's he going to play on our team? Well, 14 games, he had 14 points. He's playing pretty well, and they go, "Oh, this guy's pretty good still." You know, he kind of woke him up. He played a lot of hockey for the Red Wings as they went to the Stanley Cup Finals that year against New Jersey, his former team. Everybody's predicting a sweep, right? Detroit was 12-2 going into the Stanley Cup Finals. Everybody's saying sweep, sweep, right? You remember
They're planning the
remember
parades,
that? And it was a sweep, the wrong way, the wrong way. And so, the guy who took it hardest, can you imagine Slava Fetisov being swept in the Stanley Cup Finals by the team that traded him away? He was devastated, devastated. And everybody gave him a wide berth that night. They're on the team plane coming home, and he was sitting all by himself in a plane, just looking out the window, mopping up tears every now and then. And so it was just a horrible moment. And at one point during the flight, Vladimir Konstantinov gets up, and he walks over toward the empty seat next to Slava Fetisov.
Because no one was coming anywhere near that. The energy was so low.
And he sat down next to Slava, and he didn't say a word. He was just there. And it was, as Denise, the flight attendant, recalls, it was one of the sweetest moments that she's ever seen. And that was the moment, but it was kind of striking and very, very emotional, really, for everybody who noticed it.
Now, here's an example of how producing the documentary and being part of that helped you make a more fulfilling book.
No question, right? Because Denise's interview and a lot of other interviews took place while I was helping make the movie. And when you sit Igor Larionov down for 4 hours, you got Scotty Bowman for 2 hours in front of a camera. You got Steve Eisman for a couple hours, Brendan Shannon, Nick Lidstrom, and all the Russians except Vladimir Konstantinov. But you got all these guys for a long time. I'm thinking along the way, this is really going to help me flesh out chapters of this book. So I kind of did both at the same time, and worked out okay.
Another one of these really compelling characters, and you saw him as a teenager, Sergei Fedorov, who looks like he just stepped off of some kind of male runway. Yeah. This guy is a beautiful Adonis, right? And he's kind of a hockey diva. Am I correct?
Well, yeah, absolutely, yeah. No question. But you know, like the in the weeks right after his defection, he's living with Jim Leitz and Denise Ilitch Leitz at the time, living in their home, and you know, he's this 19-year-old, you know, blonde, blue-eyed, just a beautiful specimen of a man. You know, you could, and he's, Jim says, all of a sudden, he noticed, you know, knocking on the door every 15 minutes of another neighbor lady, a friend of Denise's, was over the house wanting to borrow something, wanting to talk about this, wanting to talk about that. All these women were parading in, trying to get a glimpse of Sergei out by the pool.
But as we go through his career, I mean, he has this unbelievable talent, has a season in 94 that no one may ever have again, five goal games. He's MVP as the leading scorer, second leading scorer. And also the defensive player, and you say he could have played another position.
Well, remember, as hardcore Red Wings fans here, remember a time when Scotty was a little short of defenseman, and he put Sergei back in defense. And Sergei resisted a little bit, but he also was very, very good. And I talked to Sergei about it, and he didn't like it. He wanted to be up front and have all the fun with the puck and so on. But I talked to Scotty at length about it, too, and Scotty said, Keith, he's really good. If he stayed back there and played defense, he would be an all-star, and he would win the Norris Trophy as the best defenseman in the league. That's how good Sergei Fedorov was. There's a lot of talk today. There's a guy down in Washington, a lot of you will recognize him, Alex Ovechkin. He won the Stanley Cup last spring. He is now, this season, became the highest goal-scoring Russian-born player of all time, and people are starting to want to call him the best Russian player ever to play in the NHL. Give me a break. Give me a break. Alex Ovechkin can score goals, no question about that. He finally won a Stanley Cup after 14 years. A lot of people were comparing him to Steve Yzerman. It took him a long time to win the Stanley Cup. But for most of his career, Alex Ovechkin needed a compass to find his defensive zone. Sergei Fedorov was great in all three zones that he played. Sergei Fedorov, for I think a 3 or 4 year span of his career, was the best hockey player in the world, bar none.
That's great stuff. It's time for a passage reading.
Oh, really?
Yep, we're going to wrap up with a beautiful passage.
I don't know if it's beautiful or not.
Well, no, it's bittersweet, or mostly bitter. This is after the terrible accident, the limo, after the celebration, 5 days after the Stanley Cup.
Okay, here it is. I got it. Depending on the route, it would have taken 30 to 40 minutes to drive from the golf club to Chris Osgood's home, where the cars were parked. Nearing the end of their trip, the limo carrying the three Russians was headed southbound on Woodward, a wide boulevard that slices through some of the world's most exclusive suburbs north of Detroit. They headed toward 16 Mile Road, which meant they were about 16 miles north on the same artery where more than a million people had gathered just 3 days earlier to honor them as they rode in red Mustang convertibles in the Stanley Cup parade. The lavish alabaster sedan was about a minute from downtown Birmingham when Fetisov felt it begin to drift across the other three lanes in what seemed like a 45-degree angle. At the same time, it was picking up speed. "What is he doing?" Fetisov wondered, his eyes on the driver. He screamed, "Hey! Hey! Hey!" The three passengers in the back, two of them world-class athletes of remarkable strength, stamina, and eye-hand coordination, were helpless to do anything as the limo, at roughly 50 miles an hour, crossed three lanes, careened off the roadway, and hurtled the curb, heading straight toward a healthy old maple tree. "This happened so fast," Fetisov recalled. "I see something coming, and now I see my life showing before me." An 8-year-old boy standing in line for 10 hours, just for the chance to spend a few minutes on the ice trying out for the Red Army Hockey School. Returning a year later and finally being accepted. Representing the motherland at the Olympic Games as a young man, only to return home humiliated after losing that crazy Miracle on Ice game. World Championship gold, 2 Olympic gold medals, becoming a husband, a father, freedom, Detroit, comrades, the Stanley Cup. "Then it was big hit, like this," Fetisov said, snapping his fingers. Glass all around the vehicle, much of it darkened to lend it the sense of privacy in the rear, shattered on impact. Metal shuddered as it wrinkled like tissue paper. The limo's front end suddenly intruding into the luxury compartment. Bodies of debris catapulted forward as the driver's airbag exploded in his face. This symphony was the soundtrack to Fetisov's memory bank, scoring the highlight reel playing in his mind, even as he was lurching forward. Bam! Then silence, save for the hissing, ticking, and clicking of a dying engine, punctuated by the ominous groan of the tree as its roots tore from the earth and began to topple in front of the twisted wreck. Just like that, the summer of celebration, 42 years in the making, was over. It had lasted 6 days when it faded to black.
Nice job, bud.
That was Keith Gave talking with Tim Rapley. Keith Gave's book is The Russian Five, a story of espionage, defection, bribery, and courage. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.